John Mark Eberhardt is a true son of Missouri. He was born in St. Joseph. He spent his childhood in St. Louis. He got his bachelor's degree at University of Missouri at Columbia and his master's at University of Missouri in Kansas City. He's a poet, a musician, a reporter and editor who since 2000 has been the book editor of the Kansas City Star. Lately, he's tried playwriting as well. He and his wife, Sherry, have written and produced a play based on the work of 25 poets. It's called Blood of Eden that was recently performed in Kansas City. His two poetry books are Night Watch and Broken Time. And it's with great pleasure that I introduce him. He's become sort of like a little brother to me. John Mark.
A rather big little brother. Well, since I'm a reporter, I'll start with a report. There are floodwaters all across Missouri. I was going to drive in yesterday, but I ended up doing it today and saw some rivers that, Sweet Springs is partly underwater. The Missouri River looks dangerous, but sort of gurgly and tepid all at the same time. I thought the Katy Trail would be underwater, but it's not. That's good. But before the flood, things were better. This is called When Dylan Went Electric. Yazger's farm was still just a field, and tie-dye trousers weren't trendy, and the Kennedys weren't dead or bloated, and the moon wasn't littered with metal, and the flood hadn't humbled us, and not all pop songs were product, and the flag was stained, but not yet soaked in blood. I'm going to read several music poems. The first half of Broken Time is all musically related. I'm from a family of musicians, and I have tried to keep up, but my brother holds a master's in percussion performance, and all I have is this lap steel guitar, but I am going to inflict one song on you later. This is an interesting year, though. It's the Fender Stratocaster, the guitar, which basically with the Gibson Les Paul sort of defined rock and roll, it was introduced in 1954. So the Fender Stratocaster is 54 years old, which I find rather disconcerting that this guitar is old enough to get AARP membership, but it's true. So in recognition of the guitar that I probably listen to much too often, I don't own a Stratocaster. They're rather expensive. But this is called On Stratocaster Road. On Stratocaster Road, all the noises belong to you. The ping of your middle fingernail on the G string. The low hum of the amp in your quarter note rest. The Wolverine scream of tortured vacuum tubes. On Stratocaster Road, you're always in the driver's seat. All your life, somebody's been in the back, bitching. Mom telling you to turn it down. Your music teacher finding fault. The goddamn next door neighbors. Yakety yak. Now you're talking back. Now you live out in the country. Now mom's gone and you miss her. Mostly. Now you take lessons from the full moon. Wax. Wane. Pick. Release. Sing to coyotes. Wolves. And this is a poem from Night Watch. Any Bella Bartok fans here? That's a weird phrase, isn't it, Bella Bartok fans? But Bartok was brilliant. And the thing is, he did so many different things. Choral music, night music with these strange sort of cricket sounds, symphonic. He was also an excellent pianist, and so was his wife, Ditta Bartok. Their son, however, Bartok wrote Microcosmos, which is a series of small piano pieces, as a piano teaching tool, and tried to get his son to start working through them, and the son eventually hit a wall. He was not the pianist his mother and father thought he should be. So this poem is based on Bartok, and it's called Microcosmos. Bartok wrote it, he said, to teach piano to the young, but his own son struggled to master the music as its complexity grew. 153 pieces, left hand seeking to know what the right hand was doing. Maybe the boy preferred baseball. Maybe his gaze wandered to the window. Maybe now, 6 decades after his father's death, he dreams in harmony. Someone was discussing Sonny Rollins at our table a little earlier. I want to read a poem about Miles Davis, who is from East St. Louis, right? I have to say my favorite trumpeter. Wynton is good, and Dizzy Gillespie was always a great, great trumpet player, but there was something about Miles Davis and the soul he put into the music. Couldn't play in the highest register, wasn't the most technically accomplished, and yet he had so much feeling. Miles Davis. He seemed sullen in the 50s, but cheered up in the 60s, once John Coltrane died and left no one to challenge him. I quit listening to him in the 70s when he started sounding just a little too satisfied. Then in the 80s, he came back, unsmiling as always, his trumpet harsher, but just right for the times. On Decoy's cover, his ravaged face stared out, hardened into onyx, with a granite upper lip that made my mouth hurt. He died in the 90s. They always die just as you're letting them back into your life. I play his music in the car at full volume, stare ahead, fused with the highway's metal chaos, a peaceful sort of rage, a meditative scorn. There are fewer curves in these last pieces he left, but even Miles' straight shots were always dangerous. I was the wire editor at the Kansas City Star the night that the news came that Miles Davis died. Editors, before the paper comes out, still do this. They gather in a room and argue about what should be on the front page. So then you can get the paper and argue about what shouldn't be on the front page, that's why we have a reader's rep. And I remember somebody in that meeting, I said, well, the wire desk, that's me that night, Miles Davis passed away. And someone said, well, he was a great trumpet player, but is that really front page news? Which I have to say was the most astonishing thing I ever heard in a news meeting. I thought, Miles Davis is dead and it's not front page news? Then nobody in this country, you know, deserves a front page obituary. The last music poem I'm going to read is called Blind Willie Johnson, who was a blues guitarist. Robert Johnson is the one most people are familiar with. Blind Willie Johnson actually was a different sort of fellow, an evangelist in the time when that meant something different than someone who's on TV and rakes in a lot of money. And this poem is based actually on his life, but also a relationship I had with someone who declared that she did not like the blues. I am no longer married to that person. Blind Willie Johnson. All the other bluesmen played the bars. Blind Willie played in church instead. Both places fed the hungry faces of the blues. At the tavern and the altar, the women sang along. Willie couldn't keep good time. His rhythms ran like children, thank you, playing in the dark down by the creek. His singing voice was loud and low and froggy. When my first wife left me, she left his records with me. I used to fight with that woman over Willie. I'd call him a genius and she'd call me a fool. I'd turn down the lights to get her in the mood. She'd turn up the TV and flip the bird at me. I got a new wife now, but I want my old one back. Just for one night, so I can prove myself right. Get her in my car and buckle her up tight. Turn up the radio, and here's what I'd say. Let's go down to Texas and dig up Blind Willie's bones. Give him a guitar and see if he still has the blues. Baby, I don't mean to be bitter, but you need to reconsider. Let's go to Texas and hear that preacher play the blues. Blind Willie Johnson, I forget the year he died, but he was not very old. There were conflicting stories. His wife, actually, his widow told them. Their house caught fire, and the fire department came, put out the fire, but they slept on wet bed sheets. They had nowhere else to go. This was in Texas. They were very poor, 40s, I guess. And so he contracted pneumonia. She took him to the hospital. Later, she had two versions of the story. One was that they refused to treat him because of his color, but the other one was they said they would not treat him because he was blind. So a hospital actually trying to convince the woman that because of his blindness, they couldn't take care of him. I don't know which story is true, but in the blues, the good part is both stories can be true. I cannot play like Blind Willie Johnson. Few people can. However, Ry Cooder based a lot of his guitar work on Blind Willie Johnson, including an entire soundtrack of music for a movie called Paris, Texas. And the title piece from that I've rearranged for lap steel guitar. And if you'll bear with me, we'll get away from the poetry for a couple minutes. We'll try this. Thank you. I've had that guitar for 2 weeks, and it's different. A lot of slide guitarists, you know, they'll play a dobro or this way, and playing this way is a little different. The slide on the blues originated from a one-stringed instrument that was called a diddly bow, which was a precursor, I think, from a guitar. And then people made instruments out of cigar boxes, which I can't even imagine. How do you get a sound out of that? Now we're spoiled. We go to Guitar Center and buy something. When I lived in St. Louis, this was from 1962 to 1970. So when I come back, it's sort of a shock, especially, you still call it West County, right? When we lived here, my father worked in construction, and it was a different landscape, I'll say that. I won't say it's better, it was better, but it certainly was a lot more open. In the summertime, he used to take me to these houses that he was working on for the construction company he worked for. So my early impression of most of the houses in St. Louis was, you know, two befores and the guts. You know, I didn't see them finished. And as fathers and sons sometimes do, we had communication problems, except when we were out, as he put it, on the job. Being on the job was very good. So I'm going to read this poem called, it's about that relationship with my dad at that time, 65, 66, 67 here. And it's called Skeletons. These houses I visit with my father are skeletons. Two carpenters, more like tailors, were dressing up all the skeletons. We bring them heavy clothes to warm their wooden bones. And my dad smiles at me when we're with the skeletons. We both love the skeletons. We tap them here and there, tap, tap with our hammers, and drive the nails through the plywood, buttoning coats for the skeletons. We're clumsy with each other. We're a perfect fit for the skeletons. When we're at home, the walls close in. When we're at home, we have words. We're at peace with the skeletons. I wish we could lock ourselves in, live with the skeletons. But the setting sun pulls us home. We cross the river beyond the help of the skeletons. And now comes the night. We are waiting for the morning light, waiting for the skeletons. And this is a poem. I also grew up partly in Andrew County, Missouri, which is northwest of St. Joe. My relatives up there were farmers at the time, although they've all been driven out of the business. You know, small farms are going or gone. And they did teach me valuable skills, how to shoot revolvers, mend fences. I can dock a boat pretty well. I've done some damage. But city and country, there are always differences, always these little schisms. And this poem was published in Coal City Review. It's called Farmers. Out here in the fields, the distances can defeat you. In our pickup trucks, we raise the dust on gravel roads, looking for signs of trouble. Corn smut, busted fences, a daughter in the hay. Now and then you see us, you city folk in your rental cars, when you take a wrong turn off the interstate and onto one of our county roads that have no names or numbers, just letters, G or B or double A. The roads are like us. They don't have much to say. When we see you out here, lost, your lips moving, your eyes wide looking for clues, we'll wave to you, or at least lift two fingers off the wheel. If you stop and roll down your windows, we'll even give you directions. We won't ask why you're so quick to get away. After all, you can't imagine why we stay. And this is a poem called The Poet at 37,000 Feet. I despise flying, and I just try to distract myself from thoughts that the whole thing is going down any minute. With various activities. Writing poetry on an airplane is really, really a bad thing to do most of the time. This was the one exception because I tried to write about the experience of trying to write poetry while I was scared to death on the airplane. The Poet at 37,000 Feet. It's a fool's errand to try to write verse up here. That antiseptic smell, those clean squalls of air from the little nozzles in the panel. I am not deceived. It reeks of death. So, of course, I do it anyway, take up the Bic, and start scratching. Most times, the results are dreadful, cliched little buggers, maybe even haiku, spoiled before the ink's dry. Except this one. This poem is giving me the willies. This poem is an engine shearing off into the blue. This one is the young father, 20 rows in front of me, bouncing his infant son to sleep, smiling because he does not know it's their last day alive. This one is burning wreckage, severed limbs, decapitation, bodies strewn over the mountains. But wait. I'm turning into William Shatner. I see something out on the wing. I discover my window will open. The death air shrieks in, but I'm a rock. I snatch these words from the page, fling them into the blue, where they burst into flame and destroy the wing-walking monster. I smell his flesh burning, goatish, sacrificial, pure. Rod Serling opens the cockpit door, resplendent in his captain's bars, and walks down the aisle to me. As he approaches, that twangy Twilight Zone music starts coming out of the overhead speakers. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do. But all he says is, "Excellent work, John. You've saved us all." It's then I notice he's ignoring the no smoking sign. There's that famous cigarette in his right hand. But wait, it's not a cigarette. It's a joint. He offers. I take a puff. Next thing I know, we're in the commercial break selling Tide to housewives. "Oh, shit, Rod," I say. I'm so stoned. But Serling looks sharply at me. "No, that's next week's episode. Shirley Jackson's The Lottery." I got in an argument with a woman one time. No, wait a minute, that's wrong. Lots of times. Poetry sometimes results from the weirdest things, and there was this argument about the moon. I was fascinated with the moon landings when I was a kid, and I made the mistake of pointing out that only men had walked on the moon. And this is the response. She claims the moon. "It's ours," she says. "It pulls at our insides." "But men went there," he says. She smiles. "We didn't have to go. It's ours." Sun, satellites, stars. All of them reflections of ripeness, fullness, birth. She claims them all. She laughs. "But men, you men can have the comets with their looping paths, lazy tails." He doesn't speak, but he thinks, "No, not even the comets." Men are bound to the earth, to the mother, tugging at her for crops, coal, gold, till she pulls us down into her forever. What the hell? For a while, I wanted to be an undertaker. did you see the show 6 Feet Under on HBO? This really glamorized that profession. And I thought, well, I'm pretty good with people most of the time, and I think I could be really good in their time of need, as they say. And then I realized I just really don't want to be around dead people. So that's just sort of a sticking point. This imagining the intersection of that sort of personality and mine, whatever those are, I wrote this. The funeral director takes a poetry class. Inhumation. Some days I almost look forward to it. A silken pillowed sleep. No need to wake again for work or play. For rush hour, airplanes, intercourse. Above, a good clean stone, letters chiseled, indifferent to the grinding wheels of circumstance. Part 2, exhumation. Being born is like being unearthed. They reach in, pull you out of that silken pillow dark, give you a good once-over. Will you be a victim or your own crime? You spend a few thousand days mulling it over, looking for clues. Then it's time for the epitaph, and someone else gets to write your ending. And I don't know how long I've been up here, but I think it's probably time for just one more. And then, does that sound good to you, Richard? Okay. So Charles Darwin has kind of made I want to read two. I'm sorry. They're both short. What? Okay, all right. Some of you might have heard about the troubles in the financial sectors today. Someone is holding, you're holding your head. It can't be that bad. I was driving down here thinking my portfolio is so small that it really doesn't matter. But I guess it was really bad. And newspapers are going through some contortions too. We had some layoffs this summer. These days I'm glad just to be working on the job, but when I wrote this poem it was a little bit less fulfilling. And the Batman movie, the new one, had just come out. So, not this year, the one before. So, this is called Bat Suit. Jokers, riddlers, are waiting to wreck your workday, waste your time with chuckles and yucks, irksome questions. Did you make your quota this month? Christina, the Catwoman, purrs at the water cooler just like yesterday. The boss is Mr. Freeze. So is your salary. So is your future. But that's okay. Utility belt? Check. Tights, gloves, bootstraps. Don the cowl. Don the cape. Trudge in today. Trudge in tomorrow. Same bat time. Same bat channel. 25 more years, and you can hang it all up. And this will be the last one. Charles Darwin is sort of made into a, what do you mean, sort of? It's made into a villain in this country very often. About a year ago, I read this newspaper story, it was sort of heartening because some churches in this country were actually celebrating Darwin's birthday, which I found interesting. And I started doing research about the man and wrote this, The Gospel of the Dirt. Darwin did believe in God. Or rather, could not quite let him go. Aboard the Beagle, his faith wavered, rocked by the beauties of the sea. If creatures no one ever saw could be this lovely, what then of the logic of the first cause? The question rankled. His daughter, Annie, died. Forced to give her to the earth, he compelled the earth to give to him. Fossils, barnacles, the tractable stomachs of burrowing owls. After The Origin of Species was published, a journalist jeered that Darwin's was the gospel of the dirt. A cartoonist stole his solemn face, mocked it, gave it the body of an ape. But Darwin lived, aged. His beard turned white. Near the end, he looked almost avuncular, a bowler Jehovah. In his follicles, cells divided, begat. In his world, as in ours, creatures unwitting made their selections, lived in their own scales, feathers, skins. Each molecule its own genesis. With every new day above ground, creation began. Thanks very much.